says that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, calling for the regime's trial. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Israel's bombardments of Gaza must immediately stop. He said Muslims around the world are angry over the regime's aggression. The leader warned that no one can stop Muslims and resistance groups if Israel continues its crimes against Palestinians. He criticized indifference to the aggression against Palestinians in the besieged territory, saying that condemning the Israeli crimes is a collective responsibility. Ayatollah Khamenei also referred to Palestinians' Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. He said those living in Israeli settlements in the occupied territories are not civilians, but they are armed settlers. The leader said the U.S. is responsible for the crimes being perpetrated against Palestinians. Ayatollah Khamenei added that evidence shows that Washington is formulating Israel's current policy toward Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Masood Shajar, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joins us from London. Masood Shajar, welcome. Regarding the crimes that are being committed by the Israeli regime, there is no doubts as to whether that's being committed or not, because A, they came out, the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs came out and said that in reference to Palestinians as animals, that they're going to kill them, and also the fact that they're going to lay a siege, both war crimes, and now a third, of which the UN has said this forced displacement of Palestinians from the north to the south is considered a crime against humanity. So the whole question of accountability, as Iran's leader has said, comes about. But how can the Israeli regime be held accountable and its officials?
Well, you're absolutely right. There is no doubt that what is happening is war crime. Is war crime because of the fact of the collective punishment? Is war crime because it's motivated by a promotion of hate, and which sort of equates the Palestinians to animals and even indeed sub-animals? So really, it's very clear that what is happening, it's a war crime, is not accidental, is designed to be war crime, and Netanyahu and others are very very easily and very publicly bragging about it in many ways. Then it comes to how they're going to be held accountable. Unfortunately, the international structures like international courts and UN and so forth are structured as such that they are really not capable to address these issues because of the fact that the structure of UN and the sort of veto powers, etc., and the way that it has been used and misused. And also, you know, the international court is so slow. It would take years and years and years before anything happened. But nevertheless, I think the public opinion now is changing so rapidly against the Zionist state that we are going to see escalation on sort of the popularity and of the Zionism and the Zionist state. And indeed, the exposure of what they are doing, everyone could see it. Yes, on one side, the leaders of the Western world and some others, including some Arab leaders, are doing a lip service to the Zionists. And they are keep on saying that, you know, they talk about the right of defense of the Israelis, when it seems that, you know, either Palestinians don't exist or they don't have any right whatsoever. They don't have right against illegal occupation. They don't have right for defending themselves. They don't have right to have water. They don't have right, any right whatsoever. And this is, unfortunately, is although it's very oppressive, but it's very clear. Even their own nation, even their own citizens are actually waking up to this abusive sort of concept being articulated by their leader. So yes, we have to go and say there has to be an end to this war crime, and it has to be now.
Another part of Iran's leader's statement made references to the U.S. and how it's actually the U.S. that is should be held responsible for the crimes that Israel is committing. That's one thing that is really not and it's naturally not highlighted by the Western media. But really, if we take a look at how the U.S. has enabled Israel to get away with its crimes for as long as it has, especially in the international arenas like the U.N., where it has backed Israel without any question, that has led to Israel to do what it has done. But in terms of what's happening right now, do you think the U.S. is actually proposing Israel to, for example, bomb the Gaza Strip to kill civilians, or is it just giving a green light, which appears by all means that it is doing at least that, for Israel to continue with its bombardment, leading to civilian deaths, obviously?
Well, it is obvious that the United States has been supporting Israel in international community structures like UN, and the number of vetoes have been used to protect Israel. It's there for everyone to see. But this goes far beyond that. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when you look at sort of Palestinians standing over the corpses of the children, and they're saying the bullets and the planes and the equipment which was used to kill these children are gift from United States to Israel, knowing Israel has been committing war crimes day in, day out. Israel is the illegal occupier. Israel is the apartheid state. And all these structures puts responsibility on every nation to oppose it, not to give it arms to commit these war crimes. So it goes far beyond the sort of protection in the international arenas like UN and elsewhere. The United States is the power which, given the equipment which is being used to commit war crimes and to kill children and to prolong illegal occupation and establishment and running the apartheid state, and is actively involved in every level. As a matter of fact, without U.S. involvement, without U.S. aid, without U.S. free arms and bullets and so forth, this atrocity would not have taken place. So they have got much more responsibility, much structural responsibility, rather than just somebody who's helping Israel.
All right, thank you very much for that. Masoud Shajarian, Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London. Thanks. Iran's foreign minister has issued yet another stern warning to Israel as the regime presses ahead with its deadly onslaught against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said the resistance front will not allow Israel to do whatever it wants in Gaza, rather turn toward other resistance groups. He warned that any preemptive measure by the resistance front is possible in the coming hours. Amir Abdollahian added, a new front will inevitably open up against Israel if it does not stop its war crimes. The top Iranian diplomat noted that the geographical map of the Israeli regime will change if the war spreads to other fronts. Asked if Iran will join the war, Amir Abdollahian said that anything is possible and no side can watch the regime's atrocities with indifference. He also censured the U.S. for urging self-restraint in the war on Gaza while supporting the Israeli regime at the same time. Rising death toll, flattened buildings with no food, water, and electricity supplies. These are what Israel's nonstop strikes, shelling, and complete blockade have brought to the Gaza Strip. The regime's fresh air raids have killed 71 Palestinians in Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. Israeli attacks also took the life of a Palestinian journalist in the north, bringing to 16 the number of journalists killed by the regime bombardment since October 7. That is when Israel launched its assaults against the besieged Palestinian territory following Palestinians' Operation Al-Aqsa flood. The total death toll from Israel's aggression now stands at over 2,800. Over 1,000 children are among the victims. The humanitarian situation is getting worse by the hour in Gaza, with hospitals facing a collapse. The World Health Organization is warning of an imminent catastrophe in the territory. The WHO official said if aid is not allowed into Gaza, patients will die. Al-Mandari added that overcrowding has paralyzed hospitals in the territory. He said intensive care units, operating rooms, emergency services, and other wings are all on the brink of collapse. According to the UN Human Rights Chief, depriving civilians of goods essential for survival is banned under international law. Palestinian resistance groups have launched more attacks against Israel retaliation for the regime's bombardment of the Gaza Strip. The military wing of Hamas resistance movement, the Izzaddin al-Qassam Brigades, fired missiles at the occupied al-Quds in response to the Israeli killing of Palestinian civilians. Also in al-Quds, the meeting of Israel's Knesset was disrupted due to the missiles from the Gaza Strip. That's according to the Palestinian media. Meanwhile, al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, has targeted an Israeli intelligence building in Kerem Shalom border crossing. Palestinian resistance fighters entered the Gaza envelope area on October 7th following missile strikes on Israeli targets under Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Nearly 1,900 Israelis have been killed and more than 3,800 injured since the beginning of the operation. Hamas says it launched a military campaign in response to repeated Israeli desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and its crimes and aggression throughout the decades. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that it is not intimidated by Israeli threats of a ground invasion of the blockaded Gaza Strip. The spokesman for the Qassam Brigade said that it is ready for any such offensive and will use it as an opportunity to severely punish Israel for its crimes against Palestinians. He vowed that Gaza would turn into a graveyard for its invaders. Abu Ubaidah added that Hamas and other resistance groups are holding 250 captives taken from Israel. He said at least 22 captives were killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza. Abu Ubaidah said that non-Israeli captives are being treated as guests and will be released when conditions are ripe. Senior Hamas leader Khaled Mashal has also said the group wants the release of some 6,000 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the Israeli captives. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, welcome. I think one of the important things that I'd like to find out from you, which may indicate what Gaza is going to be facing, is this dispatchment by the U.S. The Pentagon even made the announcement also of 200 special service members, composed of sailors, that has been now dispatched to the area. This on top of the second carrier coming. They are saying they're not going to be joining, there's no possibility of them joining if there's a ground invasion of the Israeli regime forces. But who knows? I'd like to understand your reading into this.
Well, I think Biden's also said that he's coming on Wednesday. He's obviously coming for an inspection of why the Israeli forces have done so pathetically within this standard operation that usually come and clean up. I mean, if you look at the Operation Cast Lead, which involved a 15-day ground invasion in 2009 in Gaza by the Israelis, or the Operation Pillar of Cloud, which involved a 19-day ground invasion in 2014, you can see subsequently in the 2022 conflict, and even now, it's a much more reluctant inclination to do ground invasions, and that is simply because the statistics tell you that the reality, 1,885 Zionists have been killed. Mostly those people are combatants, settlers with guns and weapons, or Israeli soldiers. Their border posts are being hit in the north on a regular basis. They aren't going into Gaza because there's a 60-kilometer tunnel network and sophisticated enough weapons to cause very, very considerable damage to the Israelis. So what we're seeing is a new kind of theater of operation. It's a theater in which the Israelis are far from confident, and now the Americans, with the warships and with all these 160 aircraft which are stationed on those warships and all the servicemen you talk about, America is obviously seriously considering coming in bolstering an Israeli army that it has very little trust in, by the looks of things. The Israeli army itself, of course, was hammered in 2000 and 2006 by Hezbollah. That bang went the Israeli military's invincibility mantra. The Iron Dome was taken down in 2022. Bang went the Iron Dome invincibility lie. And on this occasion, in Al-Aqsa Tufan, what we've seen is, so we're seeing all these myths being shattered of the military, of their surveillance system, of all their various other, much vaunted invincibility mantras around their dealing with Palestine. And I think that has worried the Americans. The Americans are now having to say, well, we're going to send in our warships, 160 or so aircraft, lots of personnel. So they're seriously considering bolstering an Israeli army that they're rapidly losing losing confidence in. The morale within the Israeli army after seeing their 2,000 or so comrades die in military action by the resistance is also going to be playing on the minds, because don't forget, these soldiers are not, they're not like even the arrogant terrorists of pre-Nakba days, where they were motivated religiously and could fight, on a real motivated basis. These are conscripts who are virtually forced to go into war, and they're not strong enough. What they're facing now is also something different. It's not just a Palestinian resistance which is with sticks and stones or shouting. It's the one which has the military training capabilities and equipment, backed up now clearly by a broader resistance which involves everybody from perhaps Kataib Hezbollah to other organization, Hezbollah, and even Ansarullah, all are pledging support for the Palestinian resistance. And Ayatollah Khamenei, as you've mentioned, has issued a warning saying, look, new fronts will open if this kind of level of genocide continues, if the water, the fuel, the food is cut off, if you stop acting like barbarians and animals towards the Palestinian civilians and ordinary folk, just to tally up the numbers, because that's what they're doing, by killing 3,000 Palestinian civilians, by killing 1,000 Palestinian children, what they're doing is playing a numbers game, trying to match up the fact that they've lost about 2,000 Zionist militants and military folk with basically comparing it with children, just to make up the numbers.
Thank you very much for that, Samuelson Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. Many thanks. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks so much for being with us. Bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at Operation Banner, the name attributed to the British Army's role during the conflict between 1969 until it officially ended in 2007. My next guest served in various units of the British Army during this period and later became a member of Veterans for Peace. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and Chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Glenn Bradley. Glenn is a former British soldier who later became an officer in the Ulster Unionist Party, participating in the talks that led to the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. Glenn continues to engage in various initiatives to advance peace, reconciliation, and evolve political thinking on the island of Ireland. Glenn Bradley, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gar Milimiaga.
Glenn, you grew up on the Shangle Road, not far from where we're actually sitting right now. Can you tell us a bit about your childhood?
First thing is, if I'd said I grew up on the Shangle Road, my granny would have beat me. I grew up on the Woodville Road, which is the top end of the Shangle. I was born in 1967 into a left-leaning, socialist-leaning, working-class family in a poverty-stricken street, two up, two down, terraced house, tin bath on the wall, no running hot water. My inheritance in life was that I was born into a loyal Irish family. What do I mean by loyal Irish? I mean that we looked eastwards for our sovereignty. We were the Irish dimension along with Welsh, English and Scots that made up the British nation, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And that is the politic that I was born into, a very hearthly home, but where politics was daily discussed, largely as a consequence of the poverty that surrounded us all. Poverty reigned in the area. Obviously, being born in 1967, it was also on the cusp of the civil uprising that was happening here in Northern Ireland. And while I had nothing to do with the previous 50 years of the Orange State and what had happened, I certainly was born into that era of violence. And in actual fact, until the ceasefires of 1994 and 1997, I knew only violence in my life. So I grew up with daily armed violence all around me on an everyday basis. You know, our days were spent listening to bombs, listening to gunfire, armed patrols on the street, para-aggression, provisional IRA aggression against my community, loyalist paramilitary violence against my community every single day on our streets.
So what motivated you then, Glenn, to join the British Army? I too grew up in a very political house and politics was discussed daily as well. We also would have understood poverty, mm-hmm. but equality and opportunities and things like that were what we were talking about. It was how we were treated compared to our neighbours a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. As far as I was concerned, I had grown up in a community that was under physical attack by the IRA. You know, day and daily, it was armed aggression against my community, and we were being failed by the RUC, we were being failed by the British Army. And in 1972, age five, I was injured in an IRA no warning car bomb. And in that small community that I come from, we knew lots of people who were getting injured. We knew lots of people who were getting killed. And it really came to a head for me on the day that Bobby Sands died. When Bobby died during that May period, you know, I was attending the Belfast Boys Model School. And our school bus was returning. And nationalists and Republicans had formed a gauntlet at the Ardoyne roundabout. And they petrol bombed our school bus. And there was lots of derogatory language being shouted, you know, burn you hun this, and so on and so forth. And but for the bravery of the bus driver on the day, who put his foot to the accelerator and actually mounted the Ardoyne roundabout and got us to the relative safety of Woodville Road, you know, the casualties would have been far higher. But it's the first day that I remember seething hatred in me. You know, I get off that bus and looking back up towards the roundabout, you know, my thought was, I'm going to kill yous. I am going to kill yous. And I was 14 years of age. And I get there's hundreds of thousands of other people would have joined the British Army without this motivation, but my motivation as a 16-year-old was quite naive at the time. You know, I was a kid who had grown up in a very closeted and tight-knit community, who was sectarian in my thinking, who believed that the Northern Ireland conflict was wholly and solely about my community and getting raped by IRA violence. And I felt that the only way that that violence could be stopped was to be met by other violence. And then I naively joined the British Army thinking, I'll get the best training possible and go back to Northern Ireland and take the fight to the enemy.
At 16?
At 16. At 16 years of age. The British Army is one of three armies in the world that recruits children into its ranks, and it is entirely legal for 16-year-olds, even now, today, in 2023. I'm talking 1984, but a child of age 16 can join the British Army.
So you joined the British Army. I mean, what was the first regiment to join? Because I understand you were in various regiments.
Yeah. I initially enlisted into the Parachute Regiment, but I also served with the Royal Irish Rangers, 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Rangers, and I also did special duty tours during Operation Banner, which would be specific to my deployments in Northern Ireland. I actually did five tours in Northern Ireland.
So, Glenn, you said you joined the British Army to get the best training. Does that mean you had an urge to join a loyalist paramilitary group, or is that what you were thinking?
As a teenager, there is no doubt that I considered joining the 1st Battalion of the Ulster Volunteer Force, the UVF, which would be a loyalist paramilitary group. You know, I come from a family that is steeped in the tradition of the UVF, and it would have been very easy, particularly with the area that I live in, for me to join B Company. But my uncle, who was a local politician at the time in the Progressive Unionist Party, put the vibes out to make sure that if I approached anyone, which I tried to do, that I would be declined the offer to enlist into the UVF. And so, yes, enlisting into a paramilitary, loyalist paramilitary, did cross my mind. But it wasn't a viable option for me because concerned relatives made sure that that course of action that would only lead to death or prison wasn't available to me. You know, that the army was the lesser of two evils, so to speak, and I was encouraged to join the British Army.
You joined the British Army. Just cut forward and on a little bit. You then, when you retired from the army, you joined the Ulster Unionist Party.
For me, the murder of my uncle, D.C. Louis Robinson, in September 1990, played heavily on me. You know, that was within our tactical area of responsibility. The 2nd Battalion, the Royal Irish Rangers, were serving as ARB, and Louis was abducted in their area. So there I was.
Do you just want to tell a bit about that, Glenn?
My uncle was Detective Constable Louis Robinson of the RUC. He had been fishing down in County Kerry, was coming back home, crossing the border, when the IRA, posing as UDR soldiers, abducted him. They held him for 3 days, torturing him, before hooding him and executing him. And that all happened within the TAOR of the regiment that I was in, the Royal Irish Rangers at that time. And I assisted in the search operation to try locate his body. I wouldn't have said it was a catalytic moment that made me get out of the army, because I went on to do a further 4 years, but there was it. And then I did a 6-month tour in Bosnia in 1992, and I think the combination of both those, I was evolving from believing that violence could satisfy things, and I was moving into a reality for me where I believed that violence was futile. And I left the army because of that in 1994.
And then, so you joined the Ulster Unionist Party at that stage then?
Yeah.
Hopes for peace or what?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, but by this stage, I'd gone from being a naive kid who worshipped at the high altar of violence to someone who believed that dialogue, engagement, equitable equality were the only things that could resolve the political situation in Northern Ireland. So I landed back here in 1994, back to the Woodfield, the area that I came from, and there was no change. There was no change from 1984 to 1984 on the poverty or anything. Nothing was being addressed. It was still the usual fly or traipse a Union Jack over a donkey and put it up for election. It would get election. And I said, no, 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 this can't continue. So I initially, again, funny enough, was going to join the Progressive Unionist Party. But my uncle felt that because of my army service, I would never be trusted. And he said, you'd be better off going into the UUP and you'd probably get further on politically than what you could. So I joined the Ulster Unionist Party. So my motivation at the Good Friday Agreement was to get a peace accord on which we could then build to create equitable equality and address all the imbalances that, in my view, had made Northern Ireland unworkable up to that point. So that was my motivation in being in the Ulster Unionist Party. So it was about, for me, it was about ground truth, community politic engagement, and addressing the causes of conflict and the reasons for gross poverty in the area that I came from.
And you later became a member of Veterans for Peace. Motivated you to do that?
For me, it was just a natural evolution of the journey and the path that I was on. You know, I go back and I say, you know, I was this naive kid who worshipped at the high altar of violence, and I'd gone through this transition to being this peacenik who simply felt that violence was futile and could achieve nothing. And Veterans for Peace for me was my natural home where I could openly discuss who I was, the journey I had been on, but also relate it to being in the army amongst people who understood my language and who could speak to me. So for me, it was just a natural evolution to join Veterans for Peace.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs around Ireland. I'm joined by our co-host, Michelle Gildernew, alongside our special guest, Glenn Bradley, who served in various regiments of the British Army and is now a member of Veterans for Peace.
Was there one particular event or one incident that sparked that desire to go from a combatant to somebody who promoted and worked towards peace?
Not that I can remember. I can't recall a singular catalytic moment. Obviously, the murder of my Uncle Louis and everything around that and my service in Bosnia, it bled heavily on me. But there's not a singular event that I can remember that made me go from this rather naive kid that had worshipped at the high altar of violence to being a peacenik. There's just nothing that is singularly correct. You know, I did 5 tours here, and as you know, serving in Fermanagh is entirely different to serving in Belfast, and the duties that a soldier would have done at that time. But what I did identify with them was the belligerence of politicians of that era, and it really, really annoyed me because no one was addressing poverty. Nobody was addressing the causes of conflict. And what I mean by the causes of conflict is, you know, at that period of time, 1986 or whatever it was, I think we had, at that stage, there was probably about 16,000 Republicans and 10,000 Loyalists had been arrested, charged through the process and were in long cash. And, you know, something didn't happen in 1968 to suddenly make, you know, over 26,000 people wake up the next morning and go, we're violent and we're going to do this. Nobody was identifying the causes of conflict, which, in my opinion, also relates to the causes of poverty because they go hand in glove together. And I just had this desire and urge that, again, coming back to what I said earlier about my children, you know, I did not want them to inherit the socioeconomic political basket case that I had been born into, and I felt a real duty and responsibility to address the causes of conflict and the reason why Northern Ireland was in such poverty, and that even today that remains my motivation. The only difference today is I'm now talking about my grandchildren, because as you know, Michelle, there was things agreed in the Good Friday Agreement, things like the Bill of Rights and so on, that we that have never, ever been addressed because politicians, some politicians here, don't want to.
I agree with you, and having been elected in 1998 into the First Assembly, I can tell you now that your worldview is very different from the vast majority of unionist politicians that I worked with, worked in committees, looked at tackling poverty. Some of the unionist politicians up there had no clue about poverty, how it existed, about how young people could end up homelessness. They just had such, they were tone deaf to the actual problems that were facing our society.
I think a lot of that is to do with political unionism and what political unionism has been doing for the last 100 years from the creation of this state. You know, as McGrandy used to say, you know, up a shankle, you could bring a donkey, traipse a union jack over it and would get elected. And that's what political unionism has been doing for 100 years. You know, back in 86, it was, 60 years I was talking about. You know, nothing has changed. You know, people from outside the areas are parachuted into the areas and they get elected because of flag waving, because of things that are completely irrelevant to addressing the causes of poverty, the causes of under-education within the unionist community. And it's an absolute disaster.
And this ethos, if you like, carried you into business. Just, do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Well, it wasn't, obviously I had to work. When I joined the Ulster Unionist Party, it was a voluntary role. You know, you're not paid to be a constituency chairman, you're not paid as the treasurer. It was about activism and it was about trying through the party to address things. So I always worked, and coming from a military background as I did, haulage and supply chains were naturally where I felt at home. So I formed a business in partnership with a guy. We were located in James's Business Park in Finglas, and we created a small cross-border haulage distribution company. And we went very quickly to making decent money.
Glenn, you're a few years older than me, but we basically want the same thing. We want a future for our children and grandchildren that's different to our upbringing. I can't ever envisage that within a six-county administration. How do you feel about how we move into the future in a way? The last 100 years, as you've pointed out, haven't been good for anybody. Society is broken here. I don't know, can it be fixed? But I don't see it ever been fixed within a six-county settlement. What's your views on that?
My view, you know, the Good Friday Agreement is our common denominator, Michelle. It's the common denominator of all the people in this region. You know, and when the people ratified the Good Friday Agreement, it became our mechanism for all political discourse. Within the Good Friday Agreement, there is the provisions for a what people call a border poll, a referendum, that the people here, of their own vocation, can choose to stay in either United Kingdom, or they can choose to go for something new. That something new to me is personally more attractive than the current status quo. You know, and within me and my political journey, I think pre-Brexit, I was maybe happy to go along with things. But Brexit irreversibly, irrevocably proved to me that this small place that we call home is of no consideration to Westminster. Because political unionism, in my opinion, and keep in mind I come from that tribe, has utterly failed to deliver, to address anything for the last 100 years. The British government has failed to address anything in the last 100 years. And I just am at that stage of life where I'm going, what's to fear from trying something new? I don't fear change. You know, my whole life has been about embracing change and evolution. So for me, you know, if the border poll was happening tomorrow, I would be voting to end the union with Britain, and I would be voting to create something anew here in Ireland that is for all of the people of this island, all 7 point whatever it is, 2 million offers, that is equal, that delivers equitable equality, that addresses poverty, that addresses social housing needs, that addresses all the issues that for the last 100 years have not been addressed in this state.
I think on that note, I want to thank you for coming in. It's great to have you today, and it's always good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
This week, we take a look at the history of Crumlin Road Jail. While this Victorian-era prison has now been transformed into a public museum, its history is one embedded in the foundations of the state, one where the hangman was always busy.
Built in 1845, Crumlin Road Jail has borne witness to a fraught period of Irish history. In its 150 years, children from impoverished families, political prisoners, and suffragettes were among 25,000 people incarcerated within its walls. The first 106 inmates who were forced to walk from Carrickfergus Prison in chains arrived in 1846. In a city where poverty was rife, children were often jailed for menial offences such as stealing food or clothing. 13-year-old Patrick McGee, who had been sentenced to 3 months in prison, hanged himself in his cell in 1858. That same year, a law was introduced forbidding children under the age of 14 to be sent to an adult prison. Women inmates were kept in the prison blockhouse until the early 1900s. Suffragettes among them, Dorothy Evans and Madge Muir, were imprisoned in the jail during 1914. Before the gallows was built in 1901, executions were carried out in full public view. An execution chamber was then constructed within the prison walls and used until the last of the hangings in 1961. 17 prisoners were executed in the prison, the last being Robert McLattery, who was hanged in 1961 for the murder of Pearl Gamble. The bodies of the executed were buried inside the prison in unconsecrated ground against the back wall beside the prison hospital. The execution of Tom Williams, a 19-year-old member of the IRA, took place on the 2nd of September, 1942. He was hanged for the killing of an RUC officer. The hangman in charge was Thomas Pierpoint, the jail's most regular hangman, who carried out 6 executions in the jail between 1928 and 1942. After a long campaign by friends and comrades of Williams, he was disinterred and buried in Milltown Cemetery in the year 2000. Despite being known as Europe's Alcatraz, there were a number of successful escape attempts at the jail. The first recorded escape was in 1866. In May 1941, 5 Irish Republican prisoners made their escape over the walls of freedom. During its 150-year history, the jail had many prisoners pass through its doors. Some of the more well-known prisoners included former Irish Taoiseach Eamon de Valera, former Deputy First Minister Martin McGuinness, and the hunger striker Bobby Sands. On the 24th of November 1991, during the last stages of the conflict, the Loyalist wing of the prison became the target of a provisional IRA bomb that killed a UVF and UDA prisoner. A rocket attack by Loyalists on the jail in the early 90s was also close to killing a number of Republicans. In 1996, the jail closed its doors for the last time, where it is now used as a museum, becoming a major tourist attraction for the many international visitors to post-conflict Belfast.
And that does it for another week. I'd like to thank our special guest, Glenn Bradley, and my co-host, Michelle Gildenew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the elements necessary for the perfection of mankind, and we said according to the plan that Quran has for mankind, faith and the righteous act and good practices are two necessary elements for becoming or achieving that goal, wise journey of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth that Quran has for us. And we said in general there are verses in the Holy Quran that praise work and tell us about the importance of work. For example, in another verse we recite, وَأَنْ لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. Mankind does not have anything but the result of his struggle and his work. This is important because sometimes we think that, for example, we have this and that positions of the world, like I have a house, I have a car. But sometimes these are not the result of my own work. This is something, a gift given to me or anything. The business of Akhirah is not like this. Anything that you want to have, you should have it through your struggle and through your own work. And nothing else would be given to people for free. Another verse that says, الَّذِينَ يُحِبُّونَ أَنْ يُحْمَدُوا بِمَا لَمْ يَفْعَلُوا. Those who want to be praised because of the things that they have not done. They think, they expect to be praised because of the things that they have not done. فَلَا تَحْسَبَنَّهُمْ بِمَفَازَةٍ مِنَ الْعَذَابِ. Do not think that they get rid from the punishment. No, they're gonna... It's not based... لَيْسَ بَأَمَانِيكُمْ وَلَا أَمَانِيَ أَهْلَ الْكِتَابِ. مَنْ يَعْمَلْ سُوءًا يُجْزَبِهِ. It is not based on your wishful thoughts or your wishes. I have a wish to be this, I have a wish to be that. No, not your wishes, not the wishes of the people of the book. That in the previous episode we said some of them believe that they are the favorite children of Allah. No, it's not based on people's wishes. مَنْ يَعْمَلْ سُوءًا. If you make a mistake, if you commit a sin, we're going to see consequences of that unless we repent. We will talk about how to make up for our mistakes. But if a person does that mistake and then doesn't repent, doesn't make up for it, then he's going to see the consequence. It's not that people telling themselves that, for example, let me do this and that and everything goes well and I ignore, for example, the fact that I did this because I'm a good servant of Allah, based on my own wishes. No, it is based on the practices. Or kullu nafsin bima kasabat rahina. To translate the verse is a bit difficult. Rahin is something like hostage. Every soul is taken hostage by its own acts or actions or practices. It's not that you say, for example, I tell a lie and then it finishes. No. This life will be with you for eternity. The actions and the mistakes that one make will be with him for eternity, unless he repents, unless he makes up for them before the moment of death. Or, for example, in another verse, وَمَنْ أَرَادَ الْآخِرَةَ وَسَعَى لَهَا سَعْيَهَا. If a person wants akhira, wants the life after this dunya and the perfection of that life, then he should work for it. And it is not something given for free, because we are the chosen creatures of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We're going to be given everything we want. That would not be the case. So these are some verses of the Holy Quran about the importance of labor and work in general. We will have a break and come back to discuss other verses and other divisions of work and practice according to the verses of the Holy Quran.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the importance of work and labor and action and practices according to the Holy Quran, in addition to the faith and belief. So the theoretical aspect of religion is faith, and the practical aspect is this system, which is a combination of legal laws and also moral advice and a whole range of suggested actions that one should have in order to arrive at that destination. So one main division in here, when we talk about human action, is the division between right and wrong actions. Quran says that there's a distinction between khair and shar, evil and good. It sounds very, for us, might sound very simple. That it's true. Why Quran emphasizes on that? But it may come surprising to some of our listeners to know that there are some people who deny this distinction. Say, there is no right and wrong. Everything could be right. Everything could be wrong. Relativism in that naive reading that, yes, anything, the distinction is a blurred distinction. And Quran stands against such ideology. أَمْ حَسِبَ الَّذِينَ اشْتَرَحُوا السَّيَّاتِ أَنْ نَجْعَلُهُمْ كَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. Really, are those who committed sins and vices, do they really think that we are going to make them equal to those who did righteous acts? سَوَاءً مَحْيَاهُمْ, both in this life and in the hereafter, there is no distinction between them. That a person leads a life of righteousness and being good to others is equal in all respects with a person who does everything wrong. No, this is sa'ama yahkumun. This is a bad judgment that some people have. Say, there is no wrong, there is no right, everything could be right. No, this is not correct. أَمْ نَجْعَلُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ كَالْمُفْسِدِينَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. Is it possible that we make or we place those who have faith and those who do righteous acts, we place them equal to those who spread falsehood and corruption on earth, كَالْمُفْسِدِينَ فِي الْأَرْضِ, or أَمْ نَجْعَلُ الْمُتَّقِينَ كَالْفُجَّارِ, or we make the pious ones like the vicious ones, كَالْفُجَّارِ. Now, Quran poses simple questions. Just ask your heart to get the answer. You know that it's not true. Your heart tells you that there is khair and shar. There is the right action and there is the wrong action. There is the immoral action. There is the moral action. So, Quran says the first principle is to accept that not everything is everything. Right and wrong is the same. No, the distinction should be there. And you should always remember this distinction in the life that you have. And based on that principle, we can talk. Otherwise, if a person insists on this combination of good and bad and everything, but then yes, there's a problem of gray areas. We should address that problem, inshallah, in the following episode. I hope, inshallah, you join me to follow up the discussion based on some of the verses of the Holy Quran. Thank you very much for listening. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran's leader calls for the trial of Israeli officials, warning that if the regime's crimes against Palestinians continue, no one can stop Muslims and their resistance forces. The World Health Organization warns of a real catastrophe in Gaza as the Israeli regime continues its bloody onslaught against the besieged territory. Also coming up, the Hamas resistance movement says it is not intimidated by Israel's ground invasion threat, warning that Gaza will turn into a graveyard for its invaders.